I'd like to call a meeting of the Environmental Quality Board to order. Welcome all of you who took the time to attend, and particularly to members of the board. Thank you for your commitment to being here today. The first item on the agenda is the adoption of the consent agenda. The proposed agenda you should have in your packet, and including in that included in that motion should be adopting of the February minutes, which are also included in your packet.
Mr. Chair, I move approval.
Yeah, February minutes. Is there a motion? There is a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Introductions, we'll, of course, start with Brian. And by the time this 8 years is over, I think everyone will pretty much know everyone that is in attendance. But please, Brian.
Brian Napstead, Chairman, Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Kate Canoe, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
John Link. Oh, sorry, Tom. My bad.
You know, there are days I just feel invisible, and this is one of them.
Well, right over you.
Sometimes.
Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of DNR.
John Linkstein, Commissioner of PCA.
Kristen Idy-Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
John Saxhog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Agriculture.
Will Seifert, Executive Director, EQB. Kevin McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner at Deed.
Adam Dunnick, Chair of the Metropolitan Council.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Very good. Thank you. You may have noticed, and I'm taking the liberty of getting rid of some of these magazines. We have 15,000 at the department, and I thought this would be a good place to start. I got out of my vehicle outside and promptly dropped every damn one of them on the ground. So if you find, you know, gravel or something mixed in, you know where that came from. It came from Stein's parking lot. This was a attempt at featuring Minnesota agriculture. I brought several others, and please help yourself as you exit, or if you'd like something to read during the meeting, like the church bulletin, you could pick it up right now as we move on with the meeting. I'm really pleased with it, particularly the page on let me see here. This one, Raise a Pint, it spends a lot of time talking about microbreweries in Minnesota, which is definitely an agricultural pursuit. We tried to feature unique things that are going on in Minnesota agriculture. We contracted with a company called Journal Communications. They come in, they sell ads. And when they're all done, they receive the ad revenue, and they give us, on a two-year basis, they'll give us copies. They've done this all across the United States with many of my colleagues that I serve with on the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. I was really pleased. The governor has a nice little warm-up message at the beginning, and certainly there are a lot of areas that we could focus on, but we chose these. We have a special section on, at the end of the magazine focusing on immigrant farmers and their unique contribution to Minnesota agriculture. Hopefully you'll enjoy that. A section on biodiesel and ethanol, which is a huge industry in Minnesota. Did you know that $472 million is the impact of craft beer sales in the Minnesota economy, Kevin, in 2012. So it's kind of a big deal. It really is. And also that the number of breweries in Minnesota has grown from 35 in 2011 to 52 in 2013, just a little statistic that you might be interested in. And that Minnesota produced almost 3 gallons of craft beer per every individual of legal drinking age in 2013. So again, another interesting little tidbit. But hopefully you'll take the magazine home and take a look at it and hopefully enjoy it. So shameless reporting on my behalf here. I also want to acknowledge and thank John Linkstein for bailing on the Germany trip and suggesting that I, in fact, lead a small delegation of people in place of John. I couldn't possibly do justice to the approach that John would have had, but thank you, John, for asking me to do that. It was very painful, but I managed to carve out a week of my life to spend in Dusseldorf, in Berlin, and in Hamburg, and to ride the fast train on a couple of occasions. And yes, Will Seifert was also along, and we maybe sampled a little German beer while we were there. But an incredible experience. The German government has hosted folks from Minnesota for the past 5 years. Kate, I think you have. Were you not any other participants? Yeah, Mike, last year. Yes.
I took
okay.
The delegation last year. Yeah.
Yes, and so and your name was mentioned numerous times, by the way, from folks that remembered your trip to.
It can be good or bad.
No, it was very positive. I straightened them out, but initially, it was very positive. Yeah, but a great opportunity to look at. Energy and energy production in Germany and their commitment to move toward sustainable and renewable energy in the near future to the extent that they will at some point be decommissioning their nuclear facilities, and their focus will be on continued production of renewables, either solar, wind, and whatever else they can come up with. And so it was a good opportunity, and again, John, I owe you. And I suppose you'll collect someday. So,
on that, Mr. Chair,
please.
German delegation is coming here in October.
Yes.
And we're going to have the opportunity to reciprocate and show all the good things we do in Minnesota, and they want to learn from the good things we're doing as leaders in the country on a lot of the energy and other things. So, it'll be fun. It'll be a good time.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that. The Minister of Agriculture from what's the area we were first in?
Dortmund.
Yeah, but
it's
the state.
North Rhine-Westphalia.
North Rhine-Westphalia. Yes. We'll be along on that trip, apparently, so we look forward to.
Yep. Minister Roman.
Yes, yes, yeah. And you met him while you were there last year, and we met him this year. So, all right. We had 19 people, many members of the legislature, members from the University of Minnesota, members from industry. And so it was a balanced group of folks, fair and balanced. And just a incredible opportunity and experience to understand. That's my report. Good to be back home. That 2 weeks out of June just kind of went goodbye. And so it's always fun to go home, but it's really, or go, but it's really fun to get back home again and sleep in your own bed after a while. So, Will?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple brief updates before we move to the agenda. On the legislative front, the governor convened a special session on Friday, June 12, to pass the remaining 16-17 budgets. The EQB budget was included in these bills that were passed with additional resources for environmental review efficiency work. Courtney is going to cover all the legislative details in her presentation. We'll be posting a position in the upcoming weeks to support our environmental review efficiency efforts. We're going to get this position filled as soon as possible, so we have been operating without a full complement in environmental review since April. Anna Sherman is assisting our efforts at this point, and she'll be with us through the end of July. As a reminder, Management Analysis Division is conducting a work planning assessment for us. They've interviewed EQB staff and tech reps thus far. They'll be interviewing board members and other agency staff who participated in EQB projects in the upcoming weeks. Please be on the lookout for that interview request. The purpose of this work is to explore alternative ways for the EQB to better operationalize board-directed initiatives. We work closely with the talented collection of agency staff through tech reps and other ad hoc interagency groups. We're trying to identify ways to optimize this work to ensure that we're making the best uses of resources efficiently. A quick note on CESIO. CESIO modeling is still being finalized at this point. A presentation on the final numbers and final analysis will be made in the fall. At our next meeting in August, we'll be focusing on the 111D Clean Power Plan rule, as well as get updates on various PUC dockets that are currently under consideration. And then our September board meeting will be presented with the water policy report that's currently being constructed. So with that, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Will on his report or anything? Seeing none, thank you, Will. Let's move then quickly to the buffer initiative. Buffer initiative, I can't recall that. Was that something that happened during?
We're in favor of it, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay, good, good. And so we're pleased to have John Jasky and Sarah Stroman here. The dream team for buffer initiatives at the legislature. Everyone wanted the job, but they prevailed and became the voice in the face of buffer initiative. And I, from the bottom of my heart, want to thank you for being the voice and face of the buffer initiative. You did a great job, and we're here to acknowledge that and also to learn a little bit more about it, because now we have to go out and sell it. So welcome, John and Sarah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we've got a presentation, but we want to make sure we leave time for questions and comments and all of that. And not only got to sell it, we actually got to do it, which is, you know, where the hard part begins. But we'll cover a little bit about what happened and more about what's coming ahead. So that's our tag team approach here. And feel free to interrupt or stop or correct us if you think that's needed too. So we're ready for anything. I will try and click this thing correctly here. So this all began, and it wasn't just, you know, Bowser or DNR. It was Bowser, DNR, MPCA, Department of Health, and Department of Agriculture. Commissioner, you were there, and you were helpful, and more help to be found going forward, I'm sure. The governor, I think you were there, and Commissioner Landwehr, as the story I was told, were with the governor when he made this announcement. I didn't know it was coming, and perhaps it was your two influences on him that this happened in the first place. I don't know.
That's going to be in my obituary. He was with the governor.
You're going to have a big old tombstone. You got a lot of things to put on that.
See, I told you I was sick. It's going to all go on there, too, yeah.
Anyhow, the governor at the DNR roundtable announced that we ought to have buffers on all the waters in Minnesota. They ought to be 50 feet, and we ought to have it done in a year or so. And so the agencies took that idea and started to work with the specifics of it, because those big ideas have to become something much more specific to get a bill passed and to make sure the bill that, if it were going to pass, you know, was going to have a way to be practically implemented. So we begun that work. And maybe Commissioner Landry wants to highlight what happened before the governor announced it, which was the governor's pheasant summit a month earlier, actually, where the issue, I think, was raised to a level that the governor, you know, thought he ought to be ready to do something. So, Tom, do you want to mention anything about that?
Well, just briefly, John, because I think the idea came up, was brought to the governor's attention by the participants at the governor's pheasant summit in Marshall. I think, Dave, you were there as well. But a poll of 300 attendees asked, what could we do to improve pheasant habitat? The number one item was enforce existing buffer law. And the governor, after that, also heard some of the reports coming out of PCA in terms of water quality and so on. And I think in his own mind, Dave and I actually met with him the night before the announcement, not ostensibly to talk about this, but in his own mind, he connected buffers with water quality, realized that, well, buffers might be good for pheasants, but more importantly, most importantly, they're good for water quality. And in the face of the evidence of PCA in terms of water quality in the state, concluded in his own mind that buffers would be a good thing, and that was going to be his signature legislation for the year.
Thank you, Tom. And so there are, you know, some background pieces. Certainly it wasn't like it just happened out of the thin blue sky. There were a lot of things that built up to this. We had done some analysis, you know, prior to the fall even, looking at whether the laws that we currently had were they going to get us where we wanted to go with a buffer practice. And it is just one practice among many, but a very important one that had some basis already in existing law. And I think when the governor heard, you know, the way those laws were working, he felt that there were some serious inadequacies. And so I think that was part of it, as Tom described. So we will dig into it a little bit more. As Commissioner Landwehr mentioned, you know, there were some analyses done both prior to the legislative session and the governor's announcement and during that time frame. These things were already on track. Of course, you don't just create a study you know, in a week or two and figure out what the science is going to tell you. These were things that have been invested in, you know, years and months prior to make sure we were getting the best information to derive the best decision making. And so this study that the MPCA released, I think it was somewhere in the April neighborhood, Commissioner Landwehr or Commissioner Stein could correct me if I'm wrong, but this was a surface water study looking at the waters of southwestern Minnesota and, you know, clearly identifying, as we had in other places, that these waters were not meeting fishable or swimmable standards. And this example was highlighted, but there were many others across the state that had similar circumstances. That's focused on the surface waters. We also know that groundwater is a key component of managing those interfaces between land use and the water. The MDA is responsible for the testing on the private wells, and they had done some work in a number of townships prior that had showed that there were some serious challenges with nitrogen leaking into the groundwater, either through surface water or directly from the land into the ground. Those areas can create risks for those consumers of those wells. You know, the nitrogen could cause health problems, and Commissioner Ellinger pointed that out on several instances as part of this rolled forward. The next report, in fact, does talk about the public water supply that Department of Health is responsible for, and they identified a number of communities around the state reliant on either surface or groundwater where they had consequences to health if they didn't treat the water before it was consumed, and that treatment was required because the water was getting into the ground that exceeded the health standards for water consumption. And I can get you more details on those reports, but if you look to the website, we created a website jointly among all the agencies that DNR hosted, and it's still there. We'll be converting that at some point, but there are a number of studies listed there. So if you go into the website and type MNDNR buffers, you'll get all that information, including the latest status reports. So as the governor tried to understand the problem, it was pretty clear that the existing laws that we had that dealt with having buffers in place or some water protection in those near shore areas, they were insufficient and confusing to boot. So we looked at these three existing requirements. There is a law, a statute that deals with drainage ditches. These are the ditches that have been dug or constructed over the last century and a half in Minnesota to remove water off the landscape to make it useful for ag production or development. And those ditch systems in Minnesota are, for the most part, managed by a public trustee, either a county government or a watershed district established for that very purpose, along with other duties that they have. But they manage these ditch systems as a piece of infrastructure, and the beneficiaries of that system pay into it to keep it functioning. And in one of those state policies that was passed long ago in 1977, the legislature had required that a one rod or 16 and a half foot buffer strip be installed along that ditch system, but only in the case where they went through a legal proceeding called a redetermination of benefits, where you reapportion the benefits and the cost of that infrastructure among all those who are participating in it. And so in the 38 years since that law passed, only 20% of the ditches had gone through that. So we only had ditches with buffers in 20% of Minnesota. So, you know, at that pace, you were going to get them all done in 150 or more years. So that was moving too slowly. That was the problem with that law. As well as if they didn't put them in, there weren't any legal consequences either. So the shoreland rule was the other requirement, not in statute, but in a DNR rule adopted in 1989 that required counties to adopt a shoreland zoning ordinance that covered all kinds of other things dealing with lake protection and nearshore preservation that included a provision in agricultural settings to not crop within 50 feet of public waters. And that ordinance then was enforced by counties. And it was, you know, sporadically at best enforced that part of that requirement. And we had you know, a few counties that did it, but most did not. And where they did not, there was nothing that could be done about it other than to go through a district court proceeding, which was very unlikely to be successful. So that was a shortcoming of that provision. And then finally, we had another piece of statute that dealt with excessive soil loss that was on the books since the 1980s, which, again, could only be implemented through an ordinance and, again, only enforced through that same mechanism, which, as in the case of the shoreland, we relied on a county attorney to prosecute cases, and that became a very challenging standard to get a county attorney to, you know, set aside all the other problems in society and try and fix, you know, soil erosion or a buffer problem. So they did it in a few cases, but in very few did it actually, you know, lead to an effective enforcement tool. A few pictures, you know, these are just some of the examples of where the problems on the landscape were identified. And, of course, you know, I got many pictures of people saying, you know, what are you going to do about these problems? And we'd say, well, absolutely nothing, because the law doesn't allow us to do anything here other than hope that somebody will do something better. And we certainly have used that approach, the voluntary approach to, you know, deal with conservation and clean water issues. And that's still going to be a very, very large part of it. But sometimes, you know, you got to get people to do a little more than they otherwise think they should do. And this is a couple of examples of that, where you've got a picture here of a public water that doesn't have the buffer it needs. And here's a picture of a other water that, of course, is, you know, having the erosion and other things that you can imagine would occur here, and the pollutants that might run downstream if you don't have some grass growing next to the water. So what do you do about this? Well, you need to improve the law. So the law that was developed, Sarah will talk about in a minute, but the one thing that we didn't have a good set of data on was how many buffers are there and how many aren't. And we still don't have that, because that's one of the things that we'll be investing some of the time here in the next year or two to work on. But the MPCA had done a statistical sample of this through, again, a piece of work that they had commissioned prior, fortunately, planning ahead, and they were able to identify in a sample fashion where buffers were and what the benefits of those buffers would be if we were to see them fully implemented. And this report is also on that website, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but the facts of the matter are that we had enough data to prove that this practice works and that it was deficient in many places. This talks about what a buffer does, or shows you, I guess, in a picture, maybe better than talking about it, but it's pretty simple. It's 1940s technology. You know, these practices have been designed and used for many, many years. The buffer holds the bank together. You know, the roots hold the bank, the soil together. It also treats water as it flows across the land in a sheet fashion. That's what a buffer does. That's the two things it does for water quality, is it holds the bank together and it treats it as it's coming across the landscape in a very flat manner, like on a table when the snow melts or the rainfall occurs. If we look at the habitat piece, of course, there's shading benefits for, you know, fish that are in the stream and, you know, other aquatic amphibians and so forth. We also have a food chain aspect of it that I think ties the water quality and the habitat together, because if you don't have good water quality, you don't have a good aquatic habitat, because if you don't have things for the fish to eat and the things for the fish to eat that are eaten by other things, you know, you don't have a healthy ecosystem in that water. It's not going to provide any habitat. So those two things come together, but we really focused on the imperative of the water quality first, because that's the thing that drives everything else in these nearshore areas. And finally, I'll just mention that, you know, we thought about how hard it would be to do this. And, you know, in some ways it seems like a big lift, but we also knew that we had six counties that actually had taken on this task on their own, more or less, although, of course, the requirements we talked about earlier were the drivers for that. And they went through a systematic assessment of their waters and communicated to their landowners what the expectations were and offered them some help. And it worked pretty well. It worked very well in those counties. So we used that as this can be done, indicator. And we also then decided that it made most sense to create a new law, not to try and fix the three that weren't working, because there's other aspects of those that continue to be important and had to stand alone. And I think those six counties showed us it was possible. I think it also showed us and highlighted the inequities. if you have six of Minnesota's 87 counties doing it, and then why not the others? And if you're a landowner in a county that did it, and you're a landowner in a county right next door that didn't, you have to wonder why that inequity can continue. And that's why the rationale for a state-wide approach to this became pretty clear. I think we also had inequities from landowner to landowner. You know, you had a farmer who put a buffer in because he knew it was the right practice, and then because one was maybe already in place downstream, and then a new landowner comes along and takes out the buffer that was already there. And they, you know, that in, that equity neighbor to neighbor becomes a really important part of this too. And so we tried to create a law that was reliant on a local delivery system that allowed for the equity to be accomplished and also to be flexible enough to put the right practice in the right place. And so I'll let Sarah talk more about that and describe how the bill is kind of put together. Okay. Sorry.
That's okay. So as John laid out, you know, the problems of water quality were pretty well understood. We understood that the laws on the books were inadequate in solving the issues. We saw that the buffers on the ground were deficient, and but the buffers could be a solution. And so the question was, what do you craft to move forward in a way that advances a solution to the problems that were identified? And so I think there were several basic tenets to the proposal that was crafted that really held through the end into what was passed. And so one, as John said, this really is sort of a new law. It was a new paradigm of how to get buffers on the land. It didn't use the same mechanisms that had been used in the past because those, frankly, didn't work. Second of all, it really took an approach that was focused on water quality. So we know that buffers have other benefits, but those were sort of taken more an approach of a voluntary add-on, that the requirements, the regulatory piece was really focused on water quality. Additionally, the bill really took an approach of a base standard. So we're going to require something that's fairly basic that everybody can meet, and again, then enhance that through other voluntary mechanisms. And lastly, I think one of those general tenets was that the law should be implemented locally, but with state oversight. And so that's really what I think as we kind of go through the elements of the bill, all of those elements are there. So just to walk through what passed briefly, one of the elements of the bill is to have a map. And the bill calls for the DNR to establish buffer protection maps. And that became a really important part of the conversation because it helps tell landowners whether the law applies to them or not. And that was one of the lessons learned from those six counties that implemented that certainty of a landowner knowing whether or not they are required to have a buffer really helps with compliance on the back end. And you need less enforcement if people just know that the law complies. So that was a really important element. Secondly, obviously, the bill had to lay out where buffers are required on the landscape, so which waters are covered and what WIS they are. And as the conversation evolved, it became important that people have some sense of those waters today without the map being produced. And so we focused on the public waters, which are known, the public drainage systems, and the bill actually included all ditches within a benefited area of a public drainage system. And then lastly, other waters that have a perennial flow, but those requirements would be set locally. So the two requirements set by the state are the average 50-foot buffer width on the public waters and the 16.5-foot on the public drainage system ditches. And again, I'll just note that this is a base standard, so the buffer that is required on those is just a perennial vegetation. It doesn't say how tall the vegetation has to be. It doesn't say how deep the roots have to be. It doesn't say what species has to be there or what diversity. It just says it has to be perennial vegetation. In terms of compliance, again, keeping with this theme of locally implemented but having state oversight, the county and watershed district have primary responsibility for issuing correction letters when an infraction is identified, having that initial contact with a landowner. They also have the first responsibility when it comes to enforcement, and that happens through an administrative fine process, which was newly created with this law. So as John says, the county attorney process was very cumbersome and a high hurdle for counties to get through. This creates a simple administrative fine process. If the watershed district or county does not want to do that, then the Board of Water and Soil Resources can step in and use that same administrative fine process. So there's that state backup. And then lastly, there is a provision also that if a local unit of government is simply not implementing the program in its totality, then the state can withhold funding from that unit of government. And so they just won't receive the aid that they would have received to implement the buffer program. And as John pointed out, when you have under the prior regime inconsistent implementation from county to county, and there was really no mechanism to go back and say, no, you need to implement it. And so this creates that level of oversight as well. Couple other components that were important to the proposal, the timeline. And so it's kind of a phased approach. The buffers on public waters need to be in place by November 2017, the public ditch systems by November of 2018. And then that other water category, those requirements need to be established by the local units of government in 2017, but the requirements may actually be, the buffers may be in place down the road from that.
And, Sarah?
Yes.
Here. What funds, going back to the last slide, what funds can be withheld if there's noncompliance on the part of the county? Just the funds that would normally be used to support the buffer strip?
Well,
it strikes me as that, I guess it's kind of after the fact, but if they decide not to participate, they're just going to lose the money that they would have normally lost anyway if they didn't participate. So,
yeah,
or is it other sets of funds?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. The bill was actually not specific. It said simply the state could withhold funds. I think there, after the bill has passed, there have been questions and concerns from counties, how broad can that be? And I think... I think that's still a question going forward, but I don't think the intent was to withhold everything that might go to a watershed district or county that would be for purposes completely unrelated to water quality or buffer issues. So I think that still has to be settled out, but I think there's an element of reasonableness that has to be applied here too. So it's not your county highway funding, for example, that might be withheld because you're not implementing a buffer.
Thanks.
Sure.
Another example of great drafting then on the part of the legislature. That's why we end up in court, isn't it? Okay.
It can be.
Mr. Chair?
Please, Eric.
Along those lines, questions about the fines, is that, I just noticed the $500 fine. Is that for landowner, for property not in compliance, or is that for linear foot, or... is that stated specifically in the?
It's in there specifically about the amount. It also says it can be reissued, and so the way we would interpret that is reissued for cause, either by not fixing the problem or not paying the fine or not achieving the restitution. So, again, the details of how that will roll out still have to be developed. So we're here with a fairly bare-bones statutory piece of language. We have to create some of the other pieces around it through either agency policy or orders and such like that. So we'll have that determined a little bit later.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
John.
Sarah or John, I guess along that line, it's a 50-foot average, 30-foot minimum. How is that determined? Who determines the average?
Sarah or John.
Well, I would say that one of the things Sarah will get to probably is that the soil and water conservation districts are there to provide what's known as a validation. So landowners don't need a permit or a permission. They just comply. If they wish to have somebody affirm their buffer requirement having been met, they can get a validation from the soil and water conservation district.
And I guess I would just add that the idea there was to provide some flexibility. So particularly, you know, along a stream, that stream corridor is not perfectly straight. It meanders. And so it often is easier both for from an implementation standpoint of a landowner, as well as, frankly, from a compliance enforcement standpoint, if you're able to square off that buffer edge into a straight line. So the averaging really is meant to provide some flexibility to the landowner, as well as some ease for the soil and water conservation districts and the county and watershed districts that have to enforce to say we need an average of 50 feet, but if it's, and it's a minimum of 32, I should say, so if it's 30 feet in one place and then, you know, 70 feet in another place, the goal is to get that average of the 50, but it allows the squaring off of the buffers with fields.
Thank you.
Yeah, and to fit, you know, the contour so that, you know, if you can imagine the bank is going like this and the river is going like this, you want a wider buffer in the low spots where the water is going to concentrate, right? And you would need a lesser buffer on the high spot where there's not water coming over the edge. So it's allowing the buffer to be installed on that particular piece of property.
Thank you.
And then the last piece I'll just note on the components of the bill is an exemptions piece. And so there are a number of areas that just blanket don't really require a buffer. And in some places, a buffer is necessary and there's or may not be necessary, but there's an alternative practice that's required. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But there are other places where just a buffer is not needed. And so these are some of the places. We were not talking about interfering with roads and trails and buildings and those kinds of things. We've also exempted areas that are enrolled in a conservation reserve program, and that's because they've already gone through a technical analysis of what practices are needed to address water quality, and so that issue has already been solved through another means. Same with the NPDES or other water quality permit issues. So it was trying to, again, be a little bit more targeted to solving specific problems and not having a one-size-fits-all, as the bill was often criticized for. And I guess not noted on this chart, but I did want to just explain this alternative practice, too. So what the law says is you have to have this buffer of either 50, average of 50 feet or the 16 and a half feet, but it does allow landowners to use an alternative practice where a buffer might not be the best way to address the water quality issues on that specific parcel of land. And so it would be the Soil and Water Conservation District that could provide a validation of that alternative practice if a landowner wants to have that validation to prove that they are in compliance with the statute.
I might add also, Sarah, that included in that is the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program that is we are working with at the Department of Agriculture. So if they're in, they're in.
Correct. Yes. So I also think it's important to look at this from a little bit different perspective because I think there was, because of the way the bill came out, focusing on the public waters, which had previously been covered under that shoreland rule that John described, and the 16 and a half foot buffer on the public drainage systems, which had been covered under the ditch buffer law, there's some confusion at the end of the day of, are we just enforcing existing law and implementing existing law in a new way, or did this really advance the ball in towards solving the problem? And so I think it's important to sort of look at what passed from a little bit different perspective and talk about what's new. And because I think there are several key ways that this did advance the ball. And the first is that it did expand the scope of waters covered, the scope of waters that are subject to a buffer requirement. And as John noted, when you look at just that public waters component, that element of the prior regulatory scheme was implemented through a rule that was enacted through local ordinance. Now that 50-foot buffer requirement is in state statute. So it's a much stronger requirement. It's much clearer. It can be implemented uniformly and with equity from county to county. The initiative also extends the 16-and-a-half requirement to ditches that have not gone through that redetermination of benefit process that John described. So when he talked about only 20% of the ditches had gone through that, had that requirement, I think that was really surprising to many folks going through this. They thought all ditches were supposed to have this buffer. And so now we've gone from that 20% to all the ditches within the benefited area of the public drainage systems. And then lastly, we get at a third category of water, these other perennial waters, through these local requirements that soil and water conservation districts need to develop and then get applied through local water plans. So we've really expanded the scope quite significantly. Then the other thing that the bill does is it sets specific timelines for implementation, which we didn't have under the ditch buffer law or under the shoreland rules. And so now we know that that buffers on public waters need to be in place by November of 2017, and the ditch buffers need to be in place by November of 2018, unless you're under that waiting for funding waiver. But we have those specific timelines. We also have better enforcement mechanism. And as John described, the enforcement mechanisms under the prior system were not very effective. There really wasn't one under the ditch buffer law, and under the shoreland ordinance, John explained, it sort of varied county to county and depended on a county attorney. And if they weren't implementing, there wasn't much the state could do about it. So we now have a more efficient local enforcement mechanism through that local administrative penalty authority, the fine, and we also have a state backup with Bowser having that administrative penalty order as well and able to use that if the county or watershed
Sarah,
district.
Did we give up the opportunity for the county attorney to handle the case during this process? I mean, the old law obviously wasn't working very well, but in the process, did we trade that away?
Mr. Chairman, no, we did not.
Still available.
That's still available.
In case of an egregious act or something, that they could go that direction.
Right. Yeah, because this law it sits alongside those previous laws, so those are still options available. And then lastly, and John talked a little bit about the soil erosion statute, we strengthened that statute significantly. So under before this new buffer law, we had the statute that prohibited excessive soil loss, but it had to be implemented or enacted through a local ordinance. And as John said, not very many counties did that. Right. So under the new buffer law, the requirement that it be enacted through that local ordinance was removed. So now it's just a state statute that this excessive soil loss is prohibited, and it ties that statute to this administrative penalty enforcement mechanism. So we now have a requirement and we have an enforcement mechanism, neither of which we really had before. And so what that allows us to do, and John showed some of these pictures earlier, but is where you have these cases where you have soil loss coming off the fields, whether it is riparian or not, we now have a mechanism to deal with that. And so that is a significant advancement of where we were before as well.
Let me just point out in this, this picture, I mean, it's not that if nature causes a disaster to occur and you couldn't have prevented it, that's not what this law is about. It's about when you could prevent something, and if you don't, it causes harm to your neighbor or harm to the water. And this is an example of where this area that's now all eroded, a couple years prior was a conservation practice. A grassed waterway was in there. It was fully handling, a 10 or 20-year storm event. And the property operation changed hands. It was a renter that took this property and farmed right through the waterway, tore it up. And then it's gone. And the laws didn't allow anything to be done other than ask this landowner if he wants to put something back there now that the harm has happened. And so that was viewed as, kind of a bad actor provision that the ag groups actually were very supportive of, because they realized that this is a small minority, but a small minority can cause a lot of harm to others. And so we needed some measure outside of the buffer corridor to also deal with these problems that, could have been prevented with a small amount of effort.
Thanks, John. So the last thing that I want to highlight is just that I think is really important is the bill appropriates funding, or actually the legacy bill appropriates funding to make this happen. And as John alluded to, there's a lot of work yet to be done to implement this and make it a reality. And so to have the funding to ensure that this all plays out in the way that was intended is really important. And so the clean water portion of the legacy bill appropriated $5 million to Bowser to support Bowser's work and to support the soil and water conservation work that has to be done to implement this. It appropriated money to DNR to create that buffer protection map. And And then in addition, it appropriated $22 million over the biennium to soil and water conservation districts for base capacity to do conservation work. So that will be related to the buffer, but also related to the work they do with landowners implementing other types of conservation practices. And then lastly, I think it's important to point out that there's other funding available to help landowners in this effort, and that became a really big issue and point of conversation during the debate on this bill as well. And so there's several sources of funding for landowners, the primary one being the Federal Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. And there is money that is available through the current Farm Bill for landowners to enroll in the Conservation Reserve Program specifically for a buffer practice. And so that's probably the primary one. We also have the State Reinvest in Minnesota RIM reserve easements through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. There were additional funds appropriated this past session for that program out of both Clean Water Fund and Outdoor Heritage Fund. And then there's also appropriations for a new program that actually marries that state RIM easement program with the federal CRP program into a Conservation Reserve Enhancement or CREP program. And the state is in the process of preparing a proposal to USDA for that, which would bring significant additional funds into Minnesota for these and other conservation practices. So, and then the soil and water conservation districts are really the point for these funding opportunities, as well as for the technical assistance to implement this. And that's why the funding for their capacity is so important here. Before we get into more questions and discussion, I think John and I just wanted to take a minute and talk about next steps. And as we both said, there's now the heavy lifting begins to really figure out how to implement this on the ground. So for DNR's part, our role is really limited to the development of this buffer protection map. And we know that that's going to be a really important tool for the implementation on the part of soil and water conservation districts and counties and watershed districts, as well as for landowners, again, to create that certainty of whether or not this requirement applies to them. We are in the process of developing the plan for that map development. We know, based on the language in the statute, we need to look at the public waters. We need to look at those drainage systems, and so we are going to have to go out to all the drainage authorities and collect those drainage system maps and look, you know, map the ditches that are within the benefited areas of those systems. We know that we need an element of ground truthing and engagement of soil and water conservation districts in that process. We haven't figured out exactly what that will look like, but we're working on that. And we hope to have these maps out for sure within a year, the final maps completed. And there will be some iterations that local units of government and the public can engage in through that process. And then at that point, most of the implementation will be turned over to Bowser and the Soil and Water Conservation District. So do you want to talk about next steps on your end?
Well, yeah, they're being built yet. As Eric said, you know, there's still an entire enforcement protocol that has to be constructed through this NAPO mechanism. That won't be the first thing, because that doesn't kick in, remember, until 2.5 years from now for the first time. So we have to be ready for that, but that isn't the first thing. The first thing is being able to answer questions of landowners, because this is a requirement onto landowners. And the local governments, the soil and water conservation districts, you know, they're ready to do that. So we're going to get some money to them this fall as soon as we possibly can to help them be ready to help landowners. And, you know, those six counties that we looked at as the, you know, this can be done kind of inspiration and fact-finding. They had 99% compliance. You know, when they gave landowners good information, they gave them options to comply. They had someone who could help them. And in those six counties, you know, Grant County was one of the early ones, and they had about half the people sign up for the CRP program, but the other half did it themselves. Just tell me how to do it and what I can do, and maybe they can loan them a grass drill or something and get going. In Olmsted County, which is one of the other ones that did this systematically, they don't have any ditches, so it's a little bit different, but they had 90% of the people do it themselves, and they had a 99% compliance rate. I think they told me they had three people out of 470-some that were initially explained this to that decided they were going to, you know, hold out, and finally the county attorney had to get involved. But so with good, you know, procedures and good communication and good information, I think we can get most people to understand what they got to do and get it done. The ditch systems, you know, that's a little bit bigger challenge because there's many, many miles of ditch systems that don't have any buffer at all. And the landowner can put that in themselves. And one of the provisions in the law that was added allows the ditch authority to come in retrospectively and pay for that one rod after the landowner puts it in on their own dime to provide that equity back into the whole system. So the drainage authorities are going to be doing some work to figure out how they can ramp up this whole process faster to get those landowners to get payment through that mechanism too. So that's where we're at.
Questions for John or Sarah?
Mr. Chair. So I imagine there's questions about urban areas, how they're treated in this regard. Maybe you can say a little bit about that, whether municipality is covered under an NPDES permit. That's not common knowledge to many people around the state, and who is covered by those permits and who is not, and how have you heard any feedback about that urban to rural agriculture to urban area issue that needs more information or clarification?
John or Sarah?
Yeah, you know, I don't. It's kind of early yet. Actually, you know, we don't even have people that can run this program yet in our agencies. You know, so that's why you see us sitting here. But we're working on that too. But there are the urban area. There, as Sarah has said, is an exemption if you're covered under MS4 and you have an equivalent riparian protection mechanism. So, you know, if you got bare soil next to the water, or somebody's, you know, tilling over the edge, you know, the local jurisdiction, typically a city, you know, or maybe a watershed district, would be involved in fixing that through their other authorities, and that would be the way we would handle it. You know, one of the other things related to that that came up during the legislative discussion was, well, what about lakeshore owners? You know, some of them have riparian property that, you know, could be managed better too for the benefit of the public good, you know, of better water quality. What are we going to do about that? Well, this policy did not make any changes there, because if you have some form of perennial vegetation, lawn, fertilized lawn, you know, those things are already stable. Maybe they're not managed the best they could be. That's another thing to tackle. And so maybe the EQB's got some ideas about how to take on that topic next, because that is also an important a management practice. You know, how you manage your near shore property is an important thing that we all need to look at.
And that's, I would just add, I mean, most of the questions I'm hearing are from agricultural areas. They're less about, am I an MS4 or do I have an MPDS, and does this apply in an urban area? It's the question John raised is, why aren't we dealing with the pesticides and chemicals and, you know, mowing that people are doing on their lakeshore properties in the metro, or, you know, even up in the lake country? And I think, you know, one of the things I think this whole discussion opened up, I think it really was the start of a conversation about how to solve these issues. I think we all know buffers are not the silver bullet answer. They're not going to solve all of those, you know, problems that were described in the reports that John flashed up on the screen. So what comes next? And some of these, you know, we tackle through the voluntary add-ons. But I also suspect there will be future conversation. I know the governor is interested in future conversation about how do we deal with some of these groundwater issues, and, you know, how do we solve the rest of the problems we're seeing. So I think I agree with John that this really is the start of a conversation, which feels a little daunting to those of us who have to figure out how to implement this piece. But I think it's also it's a good conversation to continue.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank John and Sarah for your presentation. It's great to have you here trying to put some sideboards on a program that probably would have been easier to manage by rule than by policy, but that's the hand we're dealt with, and that's what we'll deal with. I wonder if you could try to define a little bit better this term, other waters. You've talked about the need for the DNR to put together maps of public waters and public drainages, and we keep seeing this term pop up, other waters. I think it might help define the difficult role that SWCDs are going to be going through if you help us try to understand what this term other waters might mean, because it's clearly going to be different for different SWCDs, and I'm not altogether certain if the first round of DNR maps will even include these other waters. So can you help define what those might be and how they're going to fit into the program?
Yeah. Well, so maybe I can start from a high level and then, John, feel free to add in. So the governor's original proposal talked about perennial waters. And in the original bill, that was defined as waters that had a defined bed and bank and that had a flow most of the growing season in most years. And there was a lot of conversation about that. And as I said, that approach was sort of abandoned in the statute language. I think that concept of perennial waters is what was intended by this other water. So, I mean, the other refers to it's not a public water and it's not a ditch within the benefited area of a public drainage system. I think it's not meant to include, highly intermittent streams or those kinds of things. It's meant to capture those other perennial waters that might not fall into one of those two categories. So I think the way DNR will approach this in our mapping, at least in the way that we've talked about it so far, is when we're originally talking about perennial waters, we can map that through a GIS and LIDAR exercise. We can find those areas with the bed and bank and flow. And so we will still go through that mapping exercise. But what the official buffer protection map will show are only those public waters and the ditches within the benefited area of public drainage systems. We will still have then this sort of third category of these waters that would have been mapped. We will give that data to the SWCDs for them to use. And so across the state, we'll sort of have a consistent base and a consistent approach from then where they can each go out on an individual level and say what makes sense, you know, in our county, what do we really see on the ground in terms of what needs protection from a buffer standpoint.
And John, I think it's really just the public waters and the public drainage systems are legal definitions, and we want to make sure that the legal definitions get the buffers where they're needed, but there's also going to be science that shows us there's waters that are going to need a buffer in some places that aren't in that legal definition. So that's the other waters. And we'll figure that out with this mapping exercise. But we also, you know, I've been telling people, you know, it's like if we think of a map for your county, you're going to get a map with blue lines for 50 feet, purple lines for one rod, and orange lines for other things that could be considered to also be needing a buffer. And then we have to figure out where we got a red line, which is where we don't have a buffer, and a green line where we do. That's the GIS exercise. Now, I know you can't just make, you know, five colors out of your crayon box and make this all work, but the GIS project has to figure out how to do that systematically and base it in some science. And so I think we can figure that out, but we've really not even hardly begun that yet because the legislation didn't finally pass until late June. So we gotta hurry up, but we gotta hurry up carefully.
Other questions?
I just want to clarify that. So this will include shoreland, the mapping will include buffer and shoreland? For the lakes and rivers and things.
Yes, so the statute says public waters.
Right,
so that would
right.
include those things that are, you know, in the public waters and currently covered by that shoreland.
So
zoning.
It will so trigger those traditional shoreland conversations.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Although you remember that the requirement is simply that you have perennial vegetation, so whatever, if you don't have perennial vegetation, then you've got to do something about it. Otherwise, you just keep doing what you were doing.
Comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, John and Sarah. I have a question. I know that you talked, John, a lot about neighbor to neighbor and everybody wants to be fair. Would you like to be the ambassador and take this over to North Dakota? Or maybe give it a few years and see how successful it is and show them how it works?
Well, it may take more than me. I think Commissioner Stein's going already, so he can let me know when he's going, and I'll maybe
I already
tag
got
him
voluntold by the legislature to do that. So
awesome.
I'll be doing that.
Good.
Well, and, you know, I think your point is, though, that Minnesota's, you know, half a step ahead of the other neighbors around us probably, and maybe more than that in some ways. But, again, this can get done through other means, too. You know, we know that the voluntary approach can work, but people got to want to do it, and you got to have the money to help them do it. So hopefully North Dakota will get going on that first, and if they can't get far enough, they'll do like Minnesota did and make something happen faster. But let me know when you're going. I'll consider joining you.
Thank you.
Comments, questions?
Mr. Chair?
Please, John.
John and Sarah, it seems to me that a logical way to get compliance for a farmer would be the CRP, REM, and CREP programs. Do you anticipate this happening? And if so, are those programs going to be able to handle it?
I think I think you're right. That is what's going to happen in a lot of places. You know, Commissioner Fredrickson was doing back of the napkin math during these discussions, and you know, and the CRP rates, for example, just got raised. And so I was out meeting with the Soil and Water District staff over the last week in different parts of the state, and in some places that CRP rental rate is $300 an acre. You know, over 15 years, you know, that's some pretty fair payment.
At the present price, based on the napkin, they would be better off putting it in CRPs than raising corn, because you're guaranteed to lose at the present price.
But, of course, you know, markets change, you know, and input costs change and, you know, all those things too. But so I think that is going to be a very attractive option. So can the system handle it? It can handle it in terms of the procedures. I think the question is about the volume. And we do have some additional money. We are, the Soil and Water Districts, as Sarah mentioned, are getting some additional funding for their base capacity that they long needed, and the state is providing that. They are also eligible and will be getting some dollars specific to the buffer program beginning in August. And so they'll be able to plan on that and build some capacity to get, but, you know, they have to get people that are not only good technically, but are people that can be trusted locally, because, you know, these landowners want to know somebody is going to be able to be counted on when they commit their decision-making, you know, to a local official. So we got to get good people there and keep them. That's part of that adjusting the volume. And the federal money for the CRP program, for the continuous program, is believe it or not, it's unlimited. It's uncapped by a acre enrollment or a dollar enrollment. It is an open appropriation for that program, that continuous part of that program. So that's going to be a huge opportunity for people to get in and get paid for those, putting those buffers in. And it helps because they pay for the seed and installation costs too.
Thank you.
John?
John and Sarah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we had estimated the number of acres currently in permanent vegetation in these areas. And could you say a little bit more about what I think one of the things that raised the question for me, Sarah, was just what did we gain? When you said earlier that if we look to the 103E drainage systems, for example, it was 20% of those systems had gone through the redetermination of benefits, and that meant that a significant number of those systems didn't have the necessary one rod strip, buffer strip. So we had estimated the number of acres that would be gained in permanent vegetation adjacent to permanent flowing streams. Can you say a little bit more about that?
John or Sarah?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Stein, we have a very back of the napkin estimate on that, but I think our estimate was an additional 110,000 acres that we estimate by picking up buffers where they don't exist on those public waters, even though they should, and picking up those extra ditches, and then whatever we pick up on the other waters. That's why it's very back of the napkin, because we don't even really know what those are, but we're estimating about 110,000 new acres.
I see that we're all to be, generally speaking, together at Blooming Prairie on Monday next week, July 20th, for the Southern Minnesota Land Use Expo. I am hoping that both of you will be there, because if you're not, I'm not going. they want, obviously, you all look rather vacant here on this issue. Am I the only one that's going to be there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think some of us found out about that meeting yesterday.
Oh.
And it appears that only Department of Ag and PCA were invited. So.
Really?
So, no, we are not scheduled to be there.
But, Mr. Chair, now that you've seen this presentation, you're fully equipped to answer all their questions.
It states right here that the panel will consist of myself, John Linkstein, Senators Dan Sparks, John Marty, or Matt Schmidt, and Representatives Paul Anderson, Denny McNamara, and Rod Hamilton.
That's a good group.
Assistant Commissioner Flood will be joining you, not I, since I'll be up at the Tribal Government Center for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe that day. Mr. Chair, I regret to inform you.
Okay. Well, it's an important commitment that you have, and I get that. I was prepared to make a really smart aleck comment, but I can't. All right. Well, we'll see you Monday. It should be good. This land use expo, yeah, held on a farm site 2 miles north of Blooming Prairie. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Has been highly informative and educational. A good reminder. All right. Let's move then to the next item on the agenda, which is the EQB Environmental Review Internship Update. The issue here is the EQB's Environmental Review folks will present a draft revised, quote, preparing EAW as a guide for RGU document. The document is intended to help improve understanding environmental review for responsible units of government. And we are pleased to be joined by Courtney Ehlers Nelson from our EQB staff, and a special welcome to Jessica Besky, who is here as an intern this year. And welcome to both of you, and particularly because Courtney has been here before, but particularly to you, Jessica.
Good afternoon. Yes, thank you for having us, Chair and board
members. You work here.
I work here, and I'm pleased to be in front of you because I'm pleased to talk about the internship, and it's been a pleasure to work with Jessica. So this is an exciting topic for environmental review. Before I get to introduce our 2015 environmental review intern, I just want to jog your memories a little bit, start with a little bit of background. So what's being passed around actually is exactly what I want to touch base on, and that's the environmental review improvement document. It's quite a lengthy document that came out of the 2011 executive order that asked EQB to review their environmental review processes and to identify areas for improvements and develop some recommendations. So while it's a lengthy document, I have only handed out to you just the portion that identifies the 6 recommendations that came out of that effort. So again, executive order in 2011, recommendations came out in 2012, and you have just the portion that includes those recommendations. That's important here, and also my presentation later, because we are acting on those recommendations. The first priority was actually to strengthen EQB capacity for oversight and assistance in the implementation of environmental review. And it was under that recommendation that my predecessors here at Environmental Review developed a relationship with some professors at the University of Minnesota. Professor Karen Balin and Professor Ed Nader have an undergraduate class on environmental review. And last year, that class did a little work for us. They onboarded an intern as well who did a little bit of work for us, and we followed suit this year as well. So I've had the opportunity to continue those relationships, and it's been fruitful. I even had the opportunity to present to the class, and as a result, we gained an intern in 2015 as well. As of June 1st, actually, our intern started. And now, Mr. Chair and board members, I'd like to introduce you to Jessica Besky. I've asked that Jessica tell us a little bit about herself, and then she will give us an update on how she's been working to reformat, review, and incorporate some of the governor's plain language initiative into some very old guidance documents that we've had around here at EQB. So, Jessica.
All right. Mr. Chair and board members, I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself and how I found myself interning here this summer. So I'm currently a senior at the University of Minnesota. and I will graduate in December with my Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Science, Policy, and Management, and a minor in Soil Science.
Any jobs out there?
We'll find out.
Because your parents will appreciate it, I'm sure.
Yeah. So last fall, I took the environmental review class Courtney referred to, and it was basically just an overview of environmental review in Minnesota, and we got to look at environmental review through the project proposer's perspective, the responsible government unit's perspective, and also from the perspective of citizens. So taking this class ingrained in me the importance of environmental review. So when I was asked if I wanted to do this internship, I was very happy to accept. So the project outline, there were two documents that I was charged with revising, and then I was also asked to create a EIS distribution list. Courtney prioritized the three projects. The first one, which was priority one, is preparing EAWs, a procedural guide for RGUs. This is a larger document that is very helpful for any entity that is an RGU for a project that has little to no experience with EAWs, and it walks them through step-by-step how to accomplish this. So the second document is Working with Consultants, a Guide for Project Proposers. This document is for project proposers, and it helps them determine if they need a consultant, and it also gives them helpful tips on acquiring the best consultant, whether they're doing an EAW, an EIS, or a UAR. The third project is creating the EIS distribution list, so for both draft EIS and final EIS. And this was very important to Courtney because it makes it easier for the RGU to figure out where they need to send their copies.
I'm telling you, the titles just sucked me right in.
Riveting.
Riveting, that's right.
So for the first document, preparing EAWs for the RGUs, the main objective was to give it just a general update. So this included updating the format, the logo, making sure that it was written in plain language. And then the second objective, which was really important to Courtney, was making sure that to cite the Minnesota Rule 4410. And she really wanted it to have a strong connection to the document. And then before I got started, Courtney had advised me to reach out to your tech reps and give them the original document, get some feedback, because a lot of them are agencies that are RGUs, so they would have some good feedback.
A lot of them are sitting behind you right now.
Yeah. And they're very, very helpful. And so that's how we got, the objective that I just skipped past, which was reducing the number of steps. There's other suggestions that I incorporated too, but that was like the really big one that stuck out. So the general update, we wanted to do plain language, update the logo and formatting, and then also updating the links because it's from like 2005. But the main part of this was doing the plain language was a big part of that. So as I started working on this and I started looking at it, I realized that it would probably be helpful if we actually had two documents. So the first one, kind of keep it as is with the step-by-step, very detailed, walking you through. And then a second document, which is a quick reference, which is for people who have been through the process but maybe just need a brief reminder. And so it has, the first page is right there, is just a chart. It's a flow chart, walks them through the process, and then highlights the important deadlines for the RGU. The second page is a diagram that explains who's typically an RGU for different kinds of projects. And then the third page is a checklist that they can use as they're going through the process just to make sure they've done everything they need to do. And so for the plain language, to make sure this document was complying with Governor Mark Dayton's executive order on plain language, I met with the MPCA communication staff and the EQB's communication director. where we identified that the document would need a more logical organization, that we should use the word you and other pronouns, make sure it was in the active voice, use short sentences, and give it an easy-to-read design. So I included charts, tables, and diagrams to make the information more clear, and I used the word you a lot. So here's some examples of the things I've done. This is the Venn diagram I talked about. There's some tables and some charts that were incorporated to make it easier to see. Okay, so after updating the document with the plain language and incorporating graphs and tables and things, I went from 5,883 words to 3,463 words, which is a 41% reduction. This translated to it being 3 pages shorter. Even though the words were lost, no information was lost. It was just more efficiently communicated through the visuals. Okay, so we updated the logo, and we actually also changed the title a little bit because procedural guide seemed to be too redundant, so we just made it guide. And then because this is a document for people who are not experienced with EAWs, we wanted to spell out Responsible Government Unit so that there wouldn't be any confusion with the acronym. So this is just the general, what the new formatting looks like compared to the old formatting. As you can see, there's a lot more white space, so it's a lot easier to move through, a lot easier to read. So this is an example of just some of the links that have been updated and added also to make sure that it was correct. And then, so this was citing the rule. These are just all the examples. This is very important to Courtney, and so I made sure that I cited every time the rule was mentioned, and then I also created links to the reviser website so that if they want to go and look at it themselves, what I'm specifically talking about, they can go and see it for themselves. Okay, so reducing the number of steps. The original document had 22 steps, and then Courtney, the tech reps, and I all thought that was way too many steps. So I was able to rework it down to 11 steps. And I was able to do this by consolidating the steps into a way that made sense and was easier to understand. So I'll walk you through that a little bit. So step 1 through 3 weren't actual steps. They were just more explanations of what the discretionary, mandatory, and petition EAWs are. And so I just made a table explaining those, and I put that in the overview instead of having those be steps. Steps 6 through 8 were turned into step 2, which was called Getting Started. Those steps had originally been things that that needed to be due at the beginning of the process but didn't have a particular order they needed to be done in, like starting a file or keeping track of costs or hiring a consultant. Steps 11 through 14 were turned into step 5. Step 5 was just the outreach requirements for the draft EAW, and they easily combined into one because they had to do with just, you know, you send it to the EQB, you make sure you send it to everyone on the EAW distribution list, make sure you're publishing your notice to the public. So then steps 15 through 16, I was able to combine those into step 6 that pertain to public comments. And then step 21 and 22 had to do with gathering the correct documents for the record of decision and then distributing them. So those were easily put together also. Okay. So for the second document, this one just really needed the general update. So most of that was the logo, the formatting, updating the links, and then some work on plain language. But this document actually didn't need quite as much work on plain language, but is still in the process of being updated. So here's just an example, the difference between the format. So you can see, again, it's a lot easier to read through. And then so my third project was the EIS distribution list. So I only actually had to find two additional places that they need to send the EIS, because the rest of them are on the EAW distribution list, which this is actually a part of that whole document. So I found these two places that were in the law and are in the rule, and then I contacted them, made sure that that's actually where you send it, and then I wrote up the distribution list. So what is left to do? So I just need to finish. About 2 weeks ago, I had your tech reps look over my first draft. They gave me some really, really helpful comments, and so I'm still working on incorporating some of those into that, and then finish updating, working with consultants, a guide for project proposers, and then I'll have the final mock-ups of the two documents. EQB staff will revise and finalize those, and then they will be published in the EQB website. Any questions?
So do we have an opportunity to, I see Dennis is, taking this all in, although he's standing by the door ready to run. will we have the opportunity to do a kind of a test run with this so that we get input from all parties that are impacted by it?
We certainly can, Mr. Chair and board members. The plan originally was to work very closely with our tech reps, as Jessica has done, and for us to do a kind of a final approval of the documents. When you say test run, I do have a vision and a plan for utilizing these with our RGUs in the near future. Okay. In fact, in the following presentation, we'll talk about some outreach that we plan on doing in a place where I think we can use these documents.
The whole concept was user-friendly and making it simple. And
precisely, Mr. Chair. Right. And updating it, as Jessica mentioned, these documents were over 10 years old, and so they just needed a cleanup, do some housekeeping.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Brian?
I'm just wondering if Jessica would like a job writing the buffer rules.
She does have an interest in soils, and she's a pleasure to work with. So anybody, pick her up.
Our compliments. I mean, if we were grading this project, my recommendation would to give you an A+. So both of you, excellent work.
Mr. Chair, we will take that, yes. And as Jessica said, they are draft documents. And so if you heard something that you think we could improve or think about as we finalize the documents, please let Jessica or myself know.
Okay. Comments, questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
Let's move then to the next item on the agenda, which is the 2016 EQB Environmental Review Work Plan. And Courtney is going to make that presentation. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to hear from me again. And yes, I am in front of you today because we've developed a fiscal year 2016 work plan. So in this short presentation, we're going to talk about actually what took place in the legislature. So before we jump into the work plan, there are some things that took place in 2015 session that we need to consider and we need to know about moving forward. I will run through our proposed work plan, and I look forward to your comments and your feedback at the very end. So in terms of what took place in 2015, well, I've identified at least three things that you need to know, because there are three different things that may affect the work that we do at EQB or our partners in environmental review across the state. The first change that took place that I have on your screen is a change to discretionary review. This change requires that the commissioners of the Pollution Control Agency and the commissioners of DNR notify project proposers at least 14 calendar days before they order a discretionary EAW or a discretionary EIS. So that did come about in 2015. While it does impact our statutes, at this time, I think we're all trying to understand what the new processes will be. I can't speak for MPCA or DNR, but of course, we're all trying to make sense of what took place over the 2015 session and how this will impact the work we do. Another development that took place that's relative or that's obviously in EQB's wheelhouse is a change to the silica sand interim threshold. So you may already be well aware of this, but EQB worked with the legislature to amend the language in the Environment and Agricultural Omnibus Bill to extend the interim silica sand rules until we have a final and adopted rule. So in other words, that means that the interim thresholds that were set to expire on the first of this month, this year, are actually going to remain in place until the rules are, again, written and adopted. And that, of course, has not taken place quite yet. And finally, and I will touch base on this later in the presentation as well, but we are asked to do some good cause rulemaking. So good cause rulemaking is a very expedited set of rulemaking. It's very narrowly focused on, generally, it's very narrowly focused on making some word changes within the rule. It actually impacts the EAW mandatory category for recreational trails. And so we will be initiating this rulemaking in the next month or so. In fact, a resolution will have to come before this board to formally initiate that good cause rulemaking. So, as I said, I will mention that as I go on. But what probably impacted environmental review, what I'm here to talk about most, is the fact that we did get some one-time funds, $500,000, that we are going to use in the next biennium. You also may recall that we had requested and we were included in the governor's budget for a larger budget proposal with a more robust sort of initiative. And our original budget included one-time funds specific to IT projects and some permanent funds for environmental review. This ended up being a compromise, and as you can see, we are getting some one-time funds that will support environmental review efficiencies. So it's a bit broadly worded there, and I think that's important to note. As we go forward, I'm going to talk about our proposed work plan. And in that work plan, I'm going to talk about how the environmental review efficiency dollars that I just talked about will be utilized. I'm also going to talk about at least four different areas of the environmental review program. When I was thinking about environmental review and the work that we do, it can really be divided up into four program areas. Each of those areas, I will highlight some of the work we've already done in that area and how they also align with the recommendations that came out of the 2012 environmental review improvement recommendations that we handed out. So the first program area when it comes to environmental review is just program implementation. When I think of program implementation, I think of all the things that need to be done at EQB to keep the ship afloat, especially in the area of environmental review. It's not always the most flashy and exciting stuff, but it's what we need to do. We need to answer the phones. We need to have great customer service. We need to do things like publish the monitor. We need to respond to citizen petitions. And what you see up there is not a comprehensive list. There are many things that we do, including the engagement with our stakeholders and local governments. But we plan to continue to do all of this, of course. But very exciting, especially for me, in 2016, we're going to onboard a new staff person. And I should clarify, we're going to onboard a new staff person in the next month or two. And as you can see on your screen, not only do you have a goal for that timeline, but we also note that this will use some of those environmental efficiency dollars. This will be a trend on each year's slides. We'll identify a timeline and whether we're going to use those dollars. So obviously bringing on another staff person is a great thing because it frees up more time for me, for example, to work on other areas of the program. It also is going to help us be able to respond and do our jobs that much better. Just to give you a sense of what environment review has looked like in the last 6 months, we have processed 9 citizen petitions. Doesn't sound like a lot, but we processed 8 citizen petitions in all of 2014. So just in the last 6 months, we've seen an increase, and who knows what, if that'll level out through the rest of the year, but we've certainly been very busy. The next area of environmental review is program development. Program development, this is kind of the fun stuff when we actually get a chance to think about continuous improvement, when we get to think about going above and beyond or initiating some projects we've been thinking about for a while but haven't gotten to. Some of those are things like the relationship with the University of Minnesota that we have and will continue to have. We also do things like update our guidance documents. But something kind of exciting that came out of program development in the last year has been to develop a new EQB Monitor online submission page. So I know our communications director talked to you about that last month. Now, going forward in 2016, this is kind of the exciting stuff. We plan to do things like create online and electronic trainings. We have the capabilities of doing that, and it really will make our lives and some of the lives of our RGUs, especially those at the county, township, city level, easy. And as you can see, that does fulfill another priority and a recommendation that came out of the environmental review improvement document. Another thing we hope to do very early in 2016, calendar year 2016, would be to initiate some scoping for some environmental review rulemaking. In 2012, we did the mandatory category report, and we will be using that report to inform some of that rulemaking. We will also be using that environmental review efficiency document from 2012 to help us in the scoping, and we'll also be reaching out to our stakeholders at that time.
Courtney, if I could interrupt, who will also be working on starting our next mandatory category report because it's on a 5-year cycle. So that one's going to be due in 2017. So there'll be a little bit of concurrence.
That's on a different slide.
Oh, sorry.
You can beat me there. I'm sorry. Maybe I'll speed it up. Okay, so our next area of work when it comes to environmental review are really the things we've been told to do. So the legislative directives, some statutory obligations. And in the fiscal year 2016, we are going to do the good cause rulemaking, as I already discussed. And as the executive director has just pointed out, we will also be working on the mandatory category report. He is correct. It is a 5-year report and will be due in 2017. I see this as something we can do in tandem or hand in hand with that rulemaking scoping process. The two can inform one another. And finally, when it comes to program areas, there's data management. This has been an area of the program that can take a significant amount of time, especially when we get short order data requests. As you're all aware, during that legislative session and they want numbers, it's something that is really difficult for EQB, largely because we're doing a lot of data mining. We don't keep a lot of the data. We are not often the regulated governmental unit, and therefore we don't have a lot of data on specific projects. Nevertheless, we are continuously making efforts to collect better data, to process the data that we have, and so that we can have a baseline of information going forward. But that also requires that we do a couple of things going forward in fiscal year 2016. We plan to partner with the MPCA in the development of a database called Tempo. We're very excited about this because through that partnership and possibly economies of scale in that respect, we can develop a place where environmental review staff work in, and as we get information in, whether it's through the EQB monitor or outside submissions, we can be collecting and tabulating that data in real time. There'll be less data mining at the end of the year. We'll have real-time data and a place to store that, and a place that will help us develop reports in the future. This is going to be a multi-year project, so I just want to be clear, we will be initiating this work, but this will take some time. And finally, in the interim, we are going to develop a questionnaire, as you see on the bottom of your screen, a survey for our RGUs. And so we'll develop that and send that out at the end of the calendar year. So just to get you a sense of that world that EQB Environmental Review staff can work in, this is just a very preliminary look at what that database can do already. A project would come in, for example, and we would automatically start collecting data. And it's very exciting that we could be a part of this project. So, in conclusion, I just want to affirm the fact that we are still following the executive order from 2011 and the subsequent recommendations that came out of the document in 2012. We are also making an effort to use those environment review efficiency dollars as well as an effective as we can. But probably the most important piece is that we are furthering just about all the areas of environmental review we can, whether it's just basic implementation, development, continuing to develop our data management, and of course responding to those legislative directives and statutory requirements as we can. So it is with that I'd be happy to take your questions or comments on the proposed fiscal year 2016 work plan.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Are there questions or comments? Chris? And Brian after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The information to be collected and tabulated using the TEMPO database, that is really exciting. I'm a little unclear about whether that is the information that is addressing the second priority for making information available more broadly available as it comes online on specific project proposals, or is this two track or one track, or how does this piece fit in, the second priority to the TEMPO, use of the TEMPO?
And you're referring to the second priority on the handout that I provided?
I am.
Yes. So I apologize. I did not bring it in front of me. Could you read that second priority?
Sure. Second priority, develop a better system of making information available, which is what you're talking about. But it says bringing the environmental review program by developing an enhanced system of information assembly and distribution, a central part of which would be to have web-based access to environmental review information from a central site that would get, I'm interpreting that as getting the immediate access to the details in an environmental review for a specific project. So that's my specific question.
Yes, I can answer that question. Thank you for the additional information. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, I was thinking the same myself. That speaks to a very later end goal. Our first goal is to get into a database where we can start collecting this information. But of course, the end goal is to make sure that information can then be easily accessed by anyone. Mm-hmm. That's something that, in fact, when we were included in the governor's budget, we had a one-time request for funds that would help us with this very specific IT project, and that is the project that you're identifying. Now, at this point, we didn't get those funds, and so we're going to have to do this incrementally. Our first step is to get into TEMPO, collect the information. It might be on specific projects. Likely, it'll be more of a snapshot of what took place across Minnesota at any one time, because having very specific details on a project at any one time might be difficult for EQB, as we are not always the RGU. Mm-hmm. The RGU would be the best for that information. Nevertheless, we may be able to tell you what's taking place across the state at a time.
And who the RGU would be.
And who the RGU is, exactly. And whether they're working under a petition or a mandatory category or what have you. And then again, the long-term goal is then to have all that information outward facing and accessible to the public, whether that's through a website or a web an interface of some kind. So, thank you.
I had one more, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Or should we go to Brian? You want to go first?
No, you can finish up.
And then under the fourth priority, it talks about working with local governments and other RGUs to develop best practices regarding early stakeholder engagements. I'm wondering if, when you're thinking about efficiencies at this particular funding, if you are thinking about that piece. I have lots of personal experience and belief in the importance of that. And so I'm wondering how that works in and to the efficiency work that, if it does,
Courtney,
that you're doing.
Mr. Chair and board members, thank you. That's a very astute question. I hadn't gotten to that level of thought. I do think we can get to that priority. I don't know if we'll accomplish it with what I've proposed for fiscal year 2016, but certainly we are trying to engage with our local units of government.
Yes.
And that's where I talked about doing some online trainings.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
right now we have at our fingertips a program called WebEx. Maybe some of you have heard about it, maybe you haven't, but it's a place where we can have pre-recorded trainings. It's a place where we can say, we can hold webinars, for example, something to that, where local units of government or RGUs can talk to us. We can answer questions in real time. We can record it. We can post it on our website at a later date for training purposes. I think maybe that's getting towards the priority number four, but I don't know that it would fully accomplish that.
Well, that's helpful to think about, because I think, you know, the LGU connection is one mm-hmm. that, you know, hasn't been well developed. We tend to just jump to the citizens who are often acting as kind of local, mm-hmm. trying to develop local expertise quickly. And so I would love to think about that and talk about that further. Thank you.
I'd be happy to have
a I'm so happy to see the LGU piece being made a priority.
Mm-hmm. Brian?
Courtney, you mentioned processing 9 citizen petitions so far this year.
Yes.
Can you give me a little idea what processing a citizen petition means? And then, do these petitions show up on our website? So if board members want to keep track of what's on citizens' minds, we have a way to understand what's going on with the petitions.
Courtney. Sure, Mr. Chair and board members, I'd be happy to explain. When it comes to our role in citizen petitions, it's really about evaluating those petitions for completeness. So have they met a certain set of requirements and standards? And then once we've determined that they have, they've made a good substantial environmental argument for why an EAW needs to be done. They've got a petitioner's representative. You know, some things are pretty benign. Do they have a contact, an address, those sorts of things. But once we've determined that all those things have been met, we also have to determine who the responsible governmental unit will be based on the project. And that can take the most time sometimes. Once we've determined who the RGU will be, we then move the petition onto the RGU, and that's where our role kind of ends and where the RGU picks up. Not all petitions make it to the RGU. A lot of times they come through us, and our role requires that if they are inadequate in some way, that we have to tell them how they can fix that problem. And they have an opportunity to do that and start over, essentially. But again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but of those 9, I can certainly tell you that not all of them made it entirely through the process and to the RGU. Now, as in terms of are they posted to our website, they are not posted to our website, but when a petition is moved to the RGU, it does get published in the EQB monitor. So if you're following the EQB monitor, you'll see that it'll say when a petition is moved on. And then finally, it'll also say when a petition has been, when the RGU determines to act on that petition. So if they grant an EAW process or not, that will also be published in the monitor.
So in terms of kind of monitoring what's on people's minds, a board member's first opportunity would be to see that an EAW has been moved on to an RGU, or an RGU must do an EAW.
Well, the RGU, excuse me, Mr. Chair and board members, the RGU has the discretion to decide whether they will do an EAW or not. But yes, in the monitor, it will notify you that the petition has moved from EQB to the RGU, and that RGU has the opportunity to act.
EQB website.
It's all on there.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Sidebar here. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Courtney, and looking at the first priority, it mentions the
periodic review and revision of mandatory categories. And that was, I know the governor's executive order addressed that, and I'm just curious where we're at. It's a high priority for me. Keeping the rule current and responding to changes in knowledge and information that inform us better about how to actively manage those mandatory categories. I know that the legislation talked about a five-year periodic review. I just want to know where we're at in that cycle, and it's in here, but it looks a little buried to me, and I would like it to be front and center because I think there are always that's where the nuts and bolts of the environmental review program are at, is what triggers mandatory action by an RGU. So can you say a little bit more about where that sits in our expectations?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair and board members. Right, the last time that that report was done was in 2012. And we do have a five-year statutory obligation to update and review that report. And so the next one is due in 2017. As I said, we'd like to take that 2012 report and use it to inform our rulemaking that we hope to initiate in early calendar year 2016. Also, at that time, as we begin to initiate rulemaking, we will be doing more stakeholder engagement. And so while we're doing the stakeholder engagement, we hope to develop the next mandatory category report. So we are acting on it, hopefully very early here in 2016. And I'd like to ask the executive director if he has anything more he'd like to add to that, but that is our plan.
Yeah, that's a good question, Commissioner. I mean, we do envision this as a rolling process. I'm glad you brought the question up. You know, initially, a little bit more context about kind of the budget, both the compromise and the initial proposal. The initial proposal really came from this set of recommendations. We looked at it as, in order to really move forward on these, we needed a permanent increase to our environmental review program, and that was identified within this, which is what we asked the legislature for, as well as a one-time infusion of cash for IT investments. The compromise was a one-time investment, but it was open-ended for all environments. So what we're doing is we're trying to bring a plan to you all that is the most impactful on high priority things within here, knowing that we're not going to be able to check every single box, and some of them are more long-term. But within that, we certainly do anticipate opening up a docket for mandatory categories. And as Courtney had highlighted, it's early 2016. And when we really think about what's most impactful in terms of environmental review efficiency, based on what we've talked about in previous years, I mean, the four things that really kind of jump out at us are, one is better and quicker customer service, clearer, easier to understand. There's more outreach. So we are going to the regulators and not waiting for them to come to us. There's updated rules, you know, which is a big deal for a lot of proposers. But really, one thing that can be even more impactful than all of it is this better records and data management. Because we don't have a baseline right now. We don't have a good platform we have a ton of anecdotes, but we don't have good numbers to say, you know, for this category, reviews take 9 months, and that seems like an outlier. So maybe we should think about why that is. Or, you know, for this category, there are no comments ever received. Maybe we need to think about amending the threshold up or eliminating it altogether. And so to really move forward in a way that makes a lot of sense on the rule changes, we want to make sure that we're also building a body of data that's easy to play with and manipulate so we can understand how to make the best changes. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Will. I agree. It is one of the challenges that daunts everybody who writes rules, is choosing the next language or the next number that you're going to put in that rule. And having a rational basis for doing it, you have to prove it up in your statement of need and reasonableness. So it isn't, I support all of the four things you said. I just want to reiterate that I think that for the board's sake, being relevant to the decision makers that will make future decisions about the budget for the board, to the legislature, and to the governor. This is one of the areas where, you know, you drive interest toward solving that problem, because if it gets managed out of their radar, then it does not need their solution. I just want this to be front and center, because that's how you drive their interest. We know, when we were dealing with silica sand and what's going to be done about that development issue, that drove interest in finding a solution fiscally and from a policy standpoint. I just want to make sure that we stay, that we are asking ourselves to identify those kinds of problems or challenges that we need to address. And I think there are some that need to be addressed. And board members, I hope we can have a conversation about that, because there are some areas, and if you read the whole rule, Tom always has it right here. If you ever need a copy, he's got it right there.
I want it back.
It's also online. You can read it, I might mention, for those who use technology, that there's a lot of categories that need attention. And the longer they sleep, we find this in all of our rules at this agency, at the PCA, the longer they sleep, the less valuable they are the next time you need them to be woken up. And so I just want to encourage board members to read the categories that are in the rule and ask yourselves, where can we do something better than what's currently there? It's, I think, one of the things that's hardest to get done.
Well, thank you for the suggestion, Commissioner. I will certainly look to our calendar to see if we can accelerate that that docket and that conversation, because I do agree that it's really important.
Thanks.
Other comments, Chris?
Mr. Chair, sir, I have one more comment about the data collection, and wondering Mr. Knapsett's comment about the knowing what's on the minds of people with reference to the citizens' petitions, and hoping maybe that data could also be assembled so that we have a forewarning of what tends to trigger, what issues tend to trigger, and that could probably add to the useful information. And also, I just noticed, I was rereading this, Courtney, about the early stakeholder engagement, and it actually is a direction to local governments and other RGUs. So I'm just hoping that you can consider that in your training. That goal could be integrated into the RGU training. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Eric?
Real quick, a question about tempo. I understand it's going to be implemented, being designed now. Moving forward, is any of the information on past EAW, EIS, is that going to be populated as well, so we can get, you know, have a one location to look at a longer trend? I'm just thinking, you know, to identify, and I love the idea of being able to query and identify potential new mandatory categories. It's going to take a while to get there moving forward, and I'm just wondering if that's included in the updating tempo.
Mr. Chair and board members, again, a very astute question. Tempo is really going to help us going forward. What you're talking about is a separate project, again, one that actually I had on my screen, something we've been piloting and thinking about, and one that would have been accomplished had we gotten those one-time IT funds that we were requesting earlier in the session. So at this point, not now. I guess is my answer. We're really focused on starting now with the information we have now and building going forward. And yet we know in the back of our minds we do want to get that historical data in there. But at this point, I haven't thought about when it's going to take dollars and time. So, and again, Ali, we'll turn it over to the executive director if he wants to add more.
Yeah, and I will build off that a little bit, Courtney. You know, there will be other opportunities to ask for resources to do that. I mean, what we found in the legislature, there was an opposition to that request. Actually, it was really had some pretty broad support. It's just a, you know, resource scarcity issue. And so we'll look to other sources to try and accomplish that. And we also, with some dollars in FY15, we did invest in a small pilot project with a company to do some scanning of those historical documents to get a better sense of what it will take
to do, you know, what if it's scalable and how much it would cost to get the, I think it's something like 11,000 documents going back to the early 70s archived and loaded into that. And so it's definitely something that is in the long-term plan. But in terms of short term, I think we want to make sure that we are operating in a way that we can, you know, that we can really bring this information together and analyze it going forward, and then we can load those older historical documents into it.
Eric,
I guess just to follow up, I guess maybe a suggestion if time and funds are available on a, I guess, a preliminary level. We're talking about dates, you know, turnaround time for review, has it met the 90-day, you know, that sort of thing. If that information is readily available or can be loaded into Tempo to kind of look at trends rather than all of the documents being scanned in, I understand that mm-hmm. is a very large task and resource intensive, but I don't know if it can preliminary overview information can be added to Tempo. Just okay. A thought. Did that make sense? What I was.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and board members, if I may respond, I think it makes perfect sense. Unfortunately, we're so new and working with Tempo, I can't answer your question at this time, but it's certainly something we will be looking into because, as Mr. Seufert pointed out, we need a baseline, and that would help us do our jobs a lot better. So that would be great to have, and we'll look into that.
Yeah. So I'm reminded of a thing that my mother used to say, Eric, and it was something along with the lines of when you ask for something, if it's going to happen, she always would say, we'll see. So that's the answer. We'll see.
But it's, you know, I'm going to jump on the chairman a little bit. It's more complicated than that. I mean, you know, it's a serious challenge that we want to get our arms around in a way that we can really get good information that's usable. I think when we, you know, when we really started digging into this environmental review efficiency question, it was back when the MPCA and the DNR were looking into the same questions about permit timeliness. Well, they're analyzing information that they're collecting on their own regulated parties, and we're trying to do the same, but for 87 counties and all these other entities that we don't right now have a good way of knowing when they're first contacted by a project proposer, when they submit their initial project, but then it's kicked back as incomplete, and then when they finally say it's complete, we only get it when it's published in the monitor. So one of the things that we're kind of experimenting a little bit now that we're accepting submissions electronically, we're kicking back an automatic email to them to ask them those questions, to tell them we will be doing a survey at the end of the year. Can you tell us, you know, when did the project start? You know, when were you first contacted? What were the costs that you incurred from it? Was there litigation? So a lot of other kind of sub-questions that are really important to policymakers that I don't know how we would be able to retrieve that information going back decades, but I think going forward, we just want to make sure we're collecting it consistently and asking the right questions so that it's useful.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions or comments? If not, Courtney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A good presentation. Sam, we forced you, this is initiation, we forced you to sit through 2 hours of an EQB meeting just so you can get a general sense of what goes on here at an information level. Thank you for hanging in. Sam Paskey joined the Met Council 6 months ago. He has a civil engineering degree from the University of Minnesota, about 20 years in water resources and utility management consulting on a national level. His role at the Met Council will be to help shape and implement the Council's integrated water management strategies in collaboration with regional stakeholders, and he is also leading development of an asset management program to better manage risk and stretch dollars while meeting customer expectations on our wastewater utility business. The topic for today is what is the Met Council's role regarding water? How is the Council carrying out this role, and what are some of the things we can expect over the next year or so now that you've solved the Southwest Light Rail issue? You're moving on to One Water, and so we're happy on both accounts. And also thank you, Adam Dunick, for allowing presentation to be part of our program today. And again, my apologies for having you sit through 2 hours of discussion. But I think at the same time, you get a little better understanding of some of the things that the Environmental Quality Board is up to. So, Sam Pesky.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, board members, and thanks to our council chair for helping out with this presentation. We were given, I guess, about 15 minutes to provide a broad overview of One Water, or the water role of the Met Council. A really fantastic team at the council put together exactly 15 minutes of content. Sarah Smith helped. And I will attempt to hit that target probably less than successfully of 15 minutes. But hopefully the broad information we can share can give you an idea of what we're up to. It's intended to be a little conversational if you'd like. We have a lot of slides here that are just a guide. So if you want to interrupt and explore some of it, I'll remind myself that I'm 6 months in and there's a lot I don't know, so I'll do my best. So the Met Council serves the Twin Cities region, seven counties, 3,000-ish square miles. That first slide you can see is a footprint of one of our important functions, which is protecting the health of the communities in the Twin Cities regions from untreated wastewater. So we provide a wastewater utility water treatment function in that regard. We clean up the used water in a sense. We do more than that, though. The aspect of the council I'm speaking from today cuts across a little bit, but what we're really focused in is the Environmental Services Division, which is focused around water. We have three main functions there. You might call it the core business. It's the utility function, where we're a legitimate utility charging customers for wastewater service. We also provide, and we provide a planning function in that capacity. We also provide planning functions in surface water management and also in water supply planning. We do that under the umbrella of the council's overall role in the region, which frankly is to just improve the quality of life in the region. And what we mean by quality of life is shown by the Thrive MSP 2040, which is our planning framework that rolled out recently. Our outcomes should improve in everything we're doing in water and within our division and within the council in terms of stewardship and prosperity and sustainability, livability, equity. Those outcomes should be better, and we're including accountability in that. Those aren't just words. We're being held to them in what we do every day. We can do that together. I don't think we can do it apart. And we're collaborating with among the organizations on this board quite actively in order to get to these outcomes. Integration and collaboration aren't just buzzwords. They're things we're investing in doing better every day. So driving down one level to our division, we have a mission of, and I'm going to read it because this matters. Sometimes missions and visions are useful. This is how we run our business and deliver value to the region. We provide wastewater services and integrated planning to ensure sustainable water quality and water supply for the region. That's what we do. And everything should line up with that. And it's been a very useful tool in running our business. We have a vision of being a valued leader and partner in water sustainability. And since we're talking about environmental quality, I heard water sustainability come up a lot today. That really encompasses everything. Our values are no less important, and they're how we're trying to operate internally and externally in the community, how we behave. These are values we want to be held accountable to, publicly and privately. So One Water, back to that. This is a graphic that we've been using just to better understand in a visual way what we mean by One Water. Water is a lot of things. It could be a product. We can buy water at the store. It can be a resource, something that doesn't really have a beginning or an end. It never goes away. It's just changed from one use to another and so on. So it's complex. It links. We take water from those who use it, and we clean it up. That's one of our roles. But that role doesn't live in isolation. So we're trying to describe how water links us all together. This is how we may have looked at it in the past, in a more simplistic sense. So I'm going to click the button here, and some new arrows are going to come on. And I won't get into it, but the concept here is we're starting to change how we're looking at water, as opposed to just something we use in one area and then we're done. We're trying to say, can we get more benefit out of that? So I said the wrong word earlier. I said we have wastewater treatment. I like how it got your attention. We're not looking at it like that anymore. We're looking at it as we run a water reclamation facility or resource reclamation. We can get more things out of water than just the clean water we put back in the river. We can get energy out of it, as an example. And Sarah's one of our experts in that. So that's kind of how we're approaching it. It's integrated. We can do more by looking at it in a bigger way. So the three, I'll call them silos. It's a term we've been using about the distinct areas of focus that we look at is potable water. We have a role in that in the region. We work with surface water or stormwater, we can call it that in some ways, and wastewater today in some ways and in the past more so. We looked at those things distinctly. Now we're trying to figure out ways to look at those things all together. There is no answer, like this is how you look at it. It's more of how we think about those things together. It's forcing us internally to break down our silos of how we handled those things in the past. But we're opening up so many more new opportunities, and I'll share some of those with you as we go. So what those three drops combined translate into in terms of what we do, terms we use, is we have a water supply planning function. That's the potable water drop. We have a wastewater policy and system plan, and then we provide that service, and a surface water policy. Those are policy documents that have cascaded out of the council's function in those three areas. We have, in the most recent iteration of those this year, integrated them together, I think for the first time in the way that they are done this time. It's pretty meaningful to us and to the region as well. This is an example of what that actually means, running a business, running the council and a business unit. That mission of the overall division and how that lines up with the overall council role cascades down into the business unit responsible for monitoring surface water and planning surface water quality aspects. So they have their own mission and vision that aligns all the way down. I won't go into it, but I think the linkage there is what's important. So what that group looks at and what we all look at as a result as things relate together is the water quality of the region. And this is a pretty cool chart. It shows that the region is covered in water. Of course it is. There's a lot of blue. And unfortunately, not all water is as fishable or swimmable or useful for other things that we may want. And some of the waters, I'll flip the screen here, are impaired to one degree or another. So this unit tracks impairment of water, and they're focused on making this screen less red over time. It can only happen with partnerships and collaborations with many of the folks in this room and far more others who are stakeholders in these areas. So that's one aspect of the surface water that we're focused on at the Met Council. What we're doing is, here's just a short list, I'll read some of them, of some of the things we're doing that are hitting the ground. This year, and in an ongoing way, we're releasing our comprehensive stream assessment report. I would say, a little bit of a groundbreaking way to look at surface water quality trends over time. We happen to have one of the richest data sources for water quality anywhere, actually, and I heard that come up earlier in terms of other functions, but we're recognized as having a very rich, almost priceless set of data on water quality in the region. We've been able to use that and establish I'll just say it's a pretty impressive report. It's being recognized nationally, if not beyond that, on what is the state of our surface waters. And that's going to provide the foundation of where should we focus, where are things getting better or worse, and what should we do about that. In addition to that, this unit is focused on providing stormwater management grants. And those grants aren't just trying to say, hey, how should we manage stormwater? How can we manage stormwater that may benefit other pressures we're under, like water supply pressures or wastewater system pressures? So it's an integrated approach to providing grants out to the region to provide targeted best practice demonstrations of innovative things we can do. We're also looking at how we can improve our data collection and expand the assessment we have with streams to rivers and beyond. Next is the water supply planning function. This slide shows that we have one of the richest natural resources maybe in the nation in terms of aquifer water supply in this region. And a lot of our communities depend on water from aquifers to sustain their drinking water and even water for industry. So our unit has been charged with helping the region take a look at how sustainable that is, and are there issues we need to look at, and if so, what some of those choices might be going forward. This chart, we won't get into it, is just an example of some of the work the group is doing with modeling to identify where there might be some potential concerns and if different use patterns, consumption patterns in water might have an impact on those. It's extremely high level, it's planning level work, but it's providing an indication, a very early heads up of, do we need to actually start thinking about some of these things in the region? It's one of our focuses right now. Actually, as this group is rolling out what they've been chartered to do by the legislature, a master water supply plan for the region, high level to guide the 100-plus water supply utilities we have in the Twin Cities region. So there's a public process in place now where we're getting input on that master plan. It's already had a significant amount of input. And then in the fall, it'll be adopted. And then in conjunction with the DNR local water supply planning process, we'll be reviewing those in the region, and the DNR, of course, is out and beyond that. But it was a very collaborative process coming up with that between the two groups. This group is also providing some grants out to communities for reduction measures in using water. So the last and final one of the three is our utility business, the wastewater treatment or water reclamation. This is a picture of really what we're up against in terms of aging infrastructure. And we hear about that a lot since we have quite a bit of infrastructure built to serve the region. We have 8 treatment plants. We have 600 miles of large interceptor sewer pipe, some up to 13 feet in diameter. The total cost of this system is over $6 billion. That's a pretty weighty number. That's replacement cost. So we definitely need to take care of it. It was all built in roughly the same amount of time. Some of it as early as the late 1800s, but generally speaking, a lot of the expansion occurred in assets that might last 100 years or 50 years or 20 in a short amount of time. So we have these bumps where we see a lot of assets expiring or reaching their age at the same time. So we have to get ahead of that. This is one of our ways of doing that, and it shows our system and its breadth and extent and where we are focusing our resources right now to make sure that the infrastructure has a high grade. This is the work we're out there doing across the region. We're investing $100+ million a year in preserving the assets that we've got out there and just trying to keep ahead and manage the risk of failure of these assets. That's one of our roles. So this group is doing quite a bit in collaboration with some of the agencies on the board. One of the big successes is we're nearing the end of a process of putting in place what we're calling internally a phosphorus bubble permit, which is giving us a lot of flexibility to manage nutrient regulation requirements at our 8 plants. That flexibility has allowed us to save probably more than $4 million in capital improvements. We were able to avoid or defer those costs. It's a pretty meaningful number. Incidentally, that's about the size of the 2012 impact of microbreweries on the economy, I learned earlier.
Attention, good. Take this home with you.
I will. There may be a link there, too. Actually, we're working with those that are in our region, those businesses, to help them. They have a higher waste stream coming out of their process area that we have to handle, and we're helping to make sure that they can do that economically. So
thank you for what you do.
It's one of the more popular aspects of our business. Thanks. We're also working on a bunch of more technical things, and we're watching some emerging regulatory requirements there, all of which require significant capital investment. So we're doing everything we can to find innovative ways, and this integrated one water management approach where we could maybe even sell some of the water coming out of our plants for watering the landscapes or industrial uses, things we're highly interested in. So let's go into an example of all that. Our newest plant serves the East Bethel area in the north side of the region. This is a plant. It's built to serve an expanded area that hadn't been served by the Met Council before like this, so it's a fairly new facility. And it is an example, a demonstration of some of the ideas we've been talking about. It has some pretty, I won't go into the technologies, but it has some pretty advanced technologies as part of it. On the back end of the process where the clean water comes out, we have what's essentially a membrane system that cleans the water to almost drinking water standards. Not every plant in Minnesota is required to have that. This plant, however, does not discharge to a river or a stream or a lake. Where does it go? We'll see in a second. That's the reason for the membrane system. The wastewater treatment process produces solids and clean water. We have to do something with the solids. Here, we're applying them on land where they help plants grow. So that's a way of reclaiming a resource instead of just saying, how can we dispose of this? We're trying to do it beneficially. That land, we're saying, maybe that could also be useful to the public. Maybe they want to have some kind of recreational opportunity there. So we put in a wood chip walking path on the land as well. It's a way of saying this isn't just an industrial facility that's dealing with something we unfortunately have to deal with. How can we make the most of it? Finally, the exciting part is the effluent, as we call it, or the clean water that comes out the other end of the plant, goes into two pipes that go for a number of miles away from the plant into a recharge area where that water then goes back into the aquifer. So we're closing the loop, and that's the reason we treat to such a high standard at this plant. We don't want to put anything into the ground that shouldn't be there. So the plant, it follows California requirements for that level of water. I guess you could call it reuse. So that's just one example of how we're trying to innovate in the future, a little demonstration at one plant. And with your help and the help of input from people all across the region, we can come up with some good innovative ideas like this that can only be done by working together. So thank you.
Just as an example at East Bethel, what's the volume of water that goes through those pipes into that recharge system? On a day or a month or a year?
I don't have the exact answer. I know it's on the smaller side. It might be in the vicinity of 1 million gallons a year, or less than 1 million gallons per day is probably more accurate. I think the plant itself was designed for somewhere in the vicinity of 10 to 20 million gallons per day.
Okay.
But it's designed for a future built-out capacity. Right now, it's treating much less than that. It's brand new. We're just taking it over.
Questions? Comments?
Wow. Mr. Chair?
Brian?
This picture reminds me of a guy's geothermal installation he was putting in his house near where I live. And I'm looking at this, and you just said 1 million gallons a day. That's a lot. Because when you look at a geothermal residential unit, it's a small fraction of that. So if you look at that, you're pumping the water anyway. It seems like the water you're pumping in that prior to recharging the groundwater, there's enough energy in that pipe probably to heat 15, 20 homes on the way. I'm just looking at that. It looks like you're installing a geothermal system. Have you thought about that?
Mr. Chair and board members, yeah. That's a really interesting question. Sarah might actually be able to elaborate on that. But there's a lot of...
Sarah, you're welcome to come up, please. yeah, we're getting sick and tired of Sam.
Absolutely. Come join the party. Yeah. There's a lot of heat in the influent actually coming into the plant, the water coming in that we could capture. Do you want to expand on that?
Board members, thank you for allowing me to come.
Absolutely.
Yes, we have been looking into it, and it's something that resource treatment plants around the nation have been considering. There are certain things that we have to consider. Temperature of the effluent, of the water coming in and out of our plant, is very important. And sometimes some of those geothermal type systems can affect the actual temperature of the water that's in those pipes. So that's something that we have to consider. Depending on where the pipes are, we have easements for land, and those easements allow for our pipe, but they don't allow for land or space around the pipe. And we don't want to put anything inside of our pipe right now because we don't really want anything blocking up the system. So it's definitely something that we're considering, but there are a lot of considerations that go into fundamentally getting it installed.
I'm just glad to hear that you've already thought of it.
Yeah. Do you want to describe how we're capturing energy from the waste stream at the large plant?
Sure. So first of all, at Metro, our largest plant here in St. Paul, Dye is the name that we'll often call it. First of all, we are reusing a lot of the water at the plant. Most of the water use at that plant is what we call effluent, which is water that is either is going through the process. As far as energy, we have an initiative to reduce our
energy use by 25% by the end of this year, and that's system-wide. Base year being 2006, and to date we've reduced our energy use by about 20%, and much of that energy use reduction is at our Metro plant because it is by far our largest plant. Some of the things that we've done there, aeration, which is the secondary process where you basically you have microorganisms and you have blowers and you're pushing the water, you're creating these bubbles, and the microorganisms help to eat up some of the sediment that is in the water that hasn't been taken out in our primary processes. The larger, it's the smaller stuff. And the way that we can reduce it, that process alone accounts for 30 to 60% of energy usage at a wastewater treatment plant. And so we've done a lot to optimize that system with the blowers and looking at filter sizes and things like that, the size of the bubbles that are coming through. Some other things that we've done, we have incinerators at our Metro plant, and those incinerators generate steam. That steam then we've used to heat our plants, which reduces the amount of natural gas that we need to purchase for heating of the plant. But we've also installed turbines to take that steam and convert to electricity. And we're continually working on ways to optimize those systems such that we can create that much more electricity. And we're always looking at the economical impact that will have on our system and our ratepayers. So balancing the costs of electricity versus natural gas, and when does it make more sense to use that turbine to create electricity versus purchasing natural gas for the heat instead to heat the boilers. It's a system, the turbine itself, we've been able to, it saves us about $700,000 in electricity a year. And for some reference, we spend system-wide about $15 million, $16 million on electricity, on energy costs. So we figure that our all the energy work that we've done system-wide has saved us about $4 million a year. So if you were to look at a graph, you would see that our energy costs have remained relatively constant over time, but rates are going up, and they're going up pretty quickly. So we've been able to manage that rate increase.
Thank you.
Other questions? I was wondering about the 2016 Comprehensive River Assessment Report. What have you scoped that down in terms of what you plan to look at? And are there other entities that are basically looking at the same thing? I think of the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association, some of their work, and others.
I'm not the expert, but I can tell you that on the Met Council website, if you get to the water resources section of the website, it is fairly easy to find. There are some reports, and this report you're referring to is one of the featured reports. So there's some summary sheets. It's an extensive document. It's not a something you can put in a binder. It's a summary of multi-page summary of the overview, and then it's detailed data on each stream in the region that was assessed.
One states 216 plus.
Right.
So it's work to be done, or is it work that is completed at this point?
So the ongoing stream portion is continuing to roll out now, stream by stream, as they finish the data sets, and then the next one will be rivers. And that's 2016.
I understand.
As they expand.
The other thing is, have you the red arrows or the red numbers in or red color rather in the map, the impaired lakes and wetlands from the 2014 draft? Question always becomes, what's causing the impairment? Have you looked in depth at that?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. It depends, is the answer. It can be
sort of like we'll see, right?
Well, we did a lot of research, and that was one of the reasons the data is being collected and the assessments are being done, is to find out where are the sources of these impairments. The impairments themselves can vary, of course. But if the water body is in an agricultural area, it could be due to some of the, as we talked about first here at the meeting, could be due to some of that. If it's in an urban area, actually there might be a little too much chloride or salt in the water due to some of the urban uses. And so this report or this assessment quantifies where is all this coming from and what can we do about it.
Good. Information we absolutely need as we move ahead with public policy in that very specific area. Other questions or comments? Eric?
I just have a real quick question on just this last slide that you have up here, these recharge.
I want you to know that you've never had a real quick question. Questions. There are no quick questions from you.
Okay. Here's a real long and drawn-out question. Multiple follow-ups. This picture, are these wells, I guess, are these vertical pipes that are going into the ground, or is this kind of laterally extensive, and then like a drain field or a well? I guess is kind of what I'm, my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll provide a drawn-out answer of horizontal.
Okay.
They don't go vertically down. They're laying out those pipes so they can trickle in.
Okay. Thank you. No follow-up questions.
That was quick. Other comments or questions? Adam, thank you. We're about to adjourn. If you want to sit here for the next 1 minute, you can make it.
Okay.
No, you're excused.
I didn't expect a quick question.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Yeah. All right. Well, both of you, Sarah, Sam, thank you very much for being here. Very interesting. Glad to know the work that you all are about, and good luck to you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
That concludes our agenda at 3:30. Let the record reflect. There being no further business to bring before the EQB board, a motion to adjourn is in order. There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We stand adjourned.